Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Dr. Robert Hogan, professor and department chair of political science at LSU. Doc, welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you.
So, Doc, the bill passes by reconciliation, very narrow margin. Politically, what are the challenges for Republicans moving forward as well as Democrats?
Well, you're right. It passed by the slimmest of margins with this reconciliation. You only needed a majority in each house or each chamber of the Congress. So in many ways, this is not a bill that has, and in many of the last minute sort of provisions that were taken in and put out to satisfy different constituencies within the Republican Party, means that this is not a bill that has been sold to the American people yet. Many parts of it are very unpopular, as polling seems to indicate. We're in a different, very different policy process than we normally have in the United States. I mean, normally, in previous many decades, presidents have proposed major policy changes, and they go out to the public and sell it there. They often have many events across the country talking about touting its many positive and salutary effects that it will have on various aspects of society that they want to emphasize. And sometimes they encourage the public to write their member of Congress and tell them, hey, support my legislation. You would often, see presidents, talking to citizens and how it's going to, demonstrating, giving detailed examples of how it's going to bring a benefit to, a family of four living in Iowa or whatever. And then you have a long and deliberate process of talking about the specifics. You would have a discussion about, the effects that it would have, the upside, the downside. And there would be a lot of common ground that people have on the basic data and this, the social science that we can bring to bear on how policy would have a change. Here we have a system that's sort of been turned on its head. And this is not simply the Trump administration. This is something that you see in Democratic administrations. You have these reconciliation packages in which major changes to policies are not vetted in the sense that you get a full deliberation with the public and among the media people that talk about these sort of things. So you have a process that barely passes, and people are sort of waking up and saying, okay, so what does this do? And now you, on the back end, you see the president now trying to sell it to the American people. So you have a really backwards process. And I think there are a lot of surprises in it. And given the major changes it is bringing about, I think it's something that people are going to have a lot of questions about. The biggest of which, of course, is $1 trillion, that is with a T, is going to be reduced in Medicaid spending. And that is a tremendous change that has, given the size of Medicaid in this country, has a ripple effect throughout the healthcare industry. And there are many people in states that have large rural populations worried about the ability of healthcare or to get the same level of healthcare they got in a lot of rural areas. So there are a lot of questions. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I think you were asking mostly about the politics of this, and I think that this is a backwards way of policymaking. If you look at the way we've done it in the past.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, just the messaging all around this, whether it be Democrats, Republicans. I don't know that Republicans have actually gone out, like you said, and done their homework on selling the bill. Obviously, a number of Democrats are saying a lot of different things, one being that people will die as a result of this. And forget to really, I think, put things in context when you talk about Medicaid increases over the last 5 years, 6 years, increasing by 50% as a result of a lot of what was going on with Medicaid expansion, and a lot of that was linked to what was happening in the pandemic. I just find it a little mystifying that people think that we were going to be able to continue and support and sustain that level of funding. This bill, cutting $1.3 trillion over a 10-year period of time, reduces it by about 1.5% over that 10-year period of time in increases in Social Security. Looking to the states who have shifted basically from a 50-50 share formula that was the accepted relationship for a number of years to where the federal government is now covering in some cases almost 100, but definitely over 90.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that we're talking past one another and we're not recognizing, what's actually happening here. What's really interesting to me is that a lot of the provisions in this bill were actually proposed by Barack Obama back in 2014. You know, the provider tax being reduced to 3.5%, the same thing with work requirements that were being in place because of able-bodied people receiving Medicaid and not working and not trying to get off of the public dole, so to speak, and moving folks off. It's like we have this short memory of where we are on this. And I guess, like you said, everybody's to blame because it's all about the wins and the losses and not really about how we're going to manage debt and how we're going to be able to continue forward.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't disagree with some of what you said. I think that you're right. $1 trillion may only be a 1% cut over 10 years. But you also have to consider, of course, the fact that healthcare costs, unlike the cost of televisions, goes up dramatically. It's higher than inflation for a whole variety of reasons. And so, those costs are. And when you consider that, this is a tremendous cut to Medicaid. And you're right; it is it's a shifting, right? It's a shifting of responsibilities. States have been attempting, through the provider tax, to get more out of the federal government than they did in the past. And there have been attempts, you're right, on both sides to change that formula. And, and that's something that probably should be considered. But it also is something that ought to be debated. It ought to be talked about.
And, there's no doubt.
The pros and cons need to be considered. And it's like we're not really doing that in a way that is – The process to me seems very different than in the past, and partly maybe because Trump has looked at what's happened in the past, and you see when presidents have these big initiatives like on healthcare. It started with healthcare. It doesn't always work. It's very difficult. George W. Bush wanted to alter the Social Security system, right? Wanted people to have their own savings accounts so that they could invest in the stock market. He had 100 or so town hall meetings across the country and talked about it. That went nowhere, in part because you have these entrenched interests in Washington that sort of stop everything. It's very difficult to make any change. And I think what's happened is that presidents have found that, hey, we have to figure out a different way to get things passed. And, this is what Trump is doing. But I do think that there are some big downsides to that, especially if there are hidden costs and negative effects that a lot of people aren't considering.
Yeah, there's no doubt. For me, the other day, I was listening to one of the Democrats criticizing, was a local government individual criticizing the bill and saying, unfortunately for us now, we're not going to be able to build the tennis court that we got a federal grant for. And, I've been around a long time. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, well, wait a minute. Why would the federal government be funding a tennis court? And it seems as though we have shifted these obligations from local government to state government to federal government, not wanting to face these issues. I mean, and it maybe I'm crazy, but I just don't think the federal government should be financing tennis courts. that should be local activity.
Sure.
And well, with all the big issues that we have, I mean, it just highlights to me a bastardization of setting of priorities at the federal level versus state versus local.
No, I don't. I think a lot of people would agree with that. I mean, I don't know what to say to that other than the fact that, I mean, governments over time, come up with different ways of where you get the money from, and what you do with it. I remember that it used to be that they had this revenue sharing system that came out in the 1970s where the federal government funded a lot of things like tennis courts and a lot of local level projects. Sometimes when local level governments couldn't afford it, or there are certain states, of course, as we know, that can't afford everything that they need. There are some states that are donor states and some states that are receiver states when we mix all of our money together. So the federal government is funded more by some states than others, and some, especially the blue states, who are often the donor states to some of the red states in terms of taxation, have started to resent that. We have these debates a lot, but it's like we usually often talk about one little sliver of it, and we don't put everything on the table and say, what are we doing here?
Yeah, I get nervous because I wonder, how we are ultimately going to deal with the Social Security issue, right? I mean, the recalculation the other day has now shortened the period of time or the date where we're going to have some decisions to be made. I'm not certain whether the rules are going to allow this a remediation of it or a course correction by reconciliation or not. But one would think that if this thing is going to blow up in 2032, that in 2025 we ought to be having serious conversations about it, right?
Yeah, you would hope some forward thinking on a big issue such as that. And it's one that is really, a lot of people, set their hair on fire about it and worry about it. In other ways, it is an issue that isn't too difficult to solve with some tweaks. It's one of these things where if you make some tweaks early on in advance of the cliff, it's not something that has to be that painful, but it seems to me that Washington is often, so often run, in a crisis management style where the crisis has to be imminent before policymakers want to get together and actually do something.
From a political perspective, when you look at this process that we've just been through, my thought is that it's really not conducive to improving the relations between Democrats and Republicans in the House and the Senate. Would you agree?
Oh, I would agree completely. This is, again, you would hope that the parties would get together. There would be some bipartisan agreement on some of these items. But this was, I think that the big takeaway for me from this is the tremendous amount of power that Trump has in a way that we have not seen a president have before. I don't think many people in the last few days have pointed to the political acumen of Mike Johnson in terms of getting this through the House, or Mr. Thune in the Senate. What they've been pointing out is that people are very afraid of Donald Trump. They recognize that MAGA is a force to be reckoned with, Trump can direct his voters in a way that will shut down people who are in opposition to him. I mean, you saw that with Senator Tillis in North Carolina. Reminded us all of Jeff Flake out in Arizona, and you know, people who do want to reach across the aisle, the ones that do want to compromise, are pushed aside. And I don't think that's a good recipe for governing going forward. and I think that we are, you know, we have the presidency, in a lot of people's opinion, I certainly think in the founders' opinion, had far too much power before Donald Trump stepped into office a second time. But he, the presidency has awesome powers now, I think is undeniable. And I don't know that that's something that is, beneficiary to the country in the long run.
Yeah, I think more so he diminished the authority of the leaders of the party in both respective houses, right? I mean, when we talk about, that aggressive style of leadership, I mean, Schumer has utilized it, Pelosi utilized it, having to keep the factions together within that party. Mm-hmm. Republicans, for the most part, tried and failed. And it seems to me that President Trump says, well, I can't rely on the leadership of the Republican Party in the houses because they always fragment and implode. So I'll just steamroll them. It's kind of the way I look at it. And because if I want to get anything accomplished, I'm not going to get it accomplished with because history tends to repeat itself, right? It's like
and that's a concern, I think, is that what happens going forward is that you have a president who we've grown accustomed now to a president who behaves in that way, and I think you're going to see the same sort of thing going forward on the Democratic side the next time there's a Democratic president.
Yeah, well, because if they want to get reelected and if they want to leave an imprint on the country, they can't wait around for, the inability of Congress to make a decision in many respects.
Right.
And I guess, for most of those leaders, it's incredibly frustrating. As always, totally enjoy the conversation. Dr. Robert Hogan, professor and department chair of political science at LSU. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great week.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.